There are two great revolutions that are taking place in our world right now. On the one hand, there is a surprising and welcomed revolution that is taking place in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union and in other places where communist, materialistic atheism has reigned for 40 or 70 years. There, people are turning away from evolutionary materialistic atheism. They're turning to freedom. They're turning to God. They're turning to the Bible. They're turning to religion. I had lunch not long ago with a professor at the University of Leningrad, and she was telling me how that today it is legal to teach religion in the public schools of the Soviet Union. How's that for a switch? It is not legal here, in case you hadn't heard. Last night I sat at the dinner table with Billy Graham, and he was telling about a recent debate he had at the second largest university in Russia, in Siberia. And there is a huge complex academic city that they have there, and he was debating with one of their head scientists, the man who was the head of the Department of Anthropology. And Dr. Graham asked him a question. Dr. Graham said to him, "How old do you think that man is? How long do you believe that man has been on this planet?" You know what he said? "About 10,000 years." And he asked him again, 10,000 years. And several of the men in Moscow that Dr. Gish was debating recently, he told me this afternoon, several of the scientists openly espoused creation, and others said, "Why, we've known all along that this evolution is pure nonsense." It's amazing what a marvelous teacher experience is. But there is a second revolution going on, and that is a revolution that has been going on in America. It's moving in diametrically the opposite direction. For the past three decades, since the early 60s, America has been rushing, plunging headlong away from God, religion, and the Bible, at least officially, into materialism, atheism, evolutionism, and a godless secular philosophy of life. And that, I think, is not only ironic to the greatest extreme, but is tragic as well. And certainly, it is cast into the sharpest light by the counter-revolution that is taking place in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union today. Evolution and You was my topic for this talk. And my friends, the seeds of secularism, grounded, of course, in evolution, have been and are producing a most pernicious and deadly harvest in America. I read just recently an interesting illustration of that by Dr. Ernest Gordon. Now, Dr. Ernest Gordon is the Dean Emeritus of the Princeton University Chapel. He's also the hero of the bridge over the River Kwai. He was the man who discovered the New Testament and was converted and was used to bring about the conversion of hundreds of other soldiers that were in captivity there. And when the movie was made, all of that was omitted. But he is a great man and a great hero. And he said something which I think illustrates the results of this very, very aptly. Listen to him, Dr. Ernest Gordon. Quote, during the late 50s, I was invited to address the senior class of an English department in a city high school. When I arrived at the school, the late 50s, I introduced myself to the assistant headmaster, whose office was at the entrance. He guided me to the appropriate lecture hall. 20 years later, I was invited to the same school for the same purpose. I again presented myself to the same office, but it was no longer the habitat of an educator, of the assistant headmaster. It was a command post of police, of the police inspector. Corridors and classrooms were monitored by police officers who reported regularly to the inspector. The reasons given for the change were obvious. Violence, assault, rape, drug-induced madness. I interpret this scene, he says, as evidence of the end times of a civilization that had once benefited from the Christian worldview, one that had exalted creation and people and provided the ideals essential for an authentic education. That demoralized school is the tragic consequence of a society's rejection of the biblical worldview that provided the intellectual dynamic of Western education. What is education but an expression of the prevailing culture? That is, I think, a very dramatic presentation of the bitter fruit of the materialistic evolutionary view of our time. Just recently, I was handed an article from a newspaper with a large picture of our often quoted Harvard scientist, Dr. Stephen Jay Gould. And in this article, Dr. Gould is quoted in this way: man or woman as the crowning achievement of some cosmic plan, what mortal conceit. We are an afterthought, said Gould, the distinguished paleontologist and essayist of Harvard University. A little accidental twig. Now there, from the man who is probably today America's leading evolutionist, is a definition of man, not created a little lower than the angels, but a twig. No, excuse me, not a twig, an accidental twig. A twig would be too good for you. And yet that is not altogether accurate. Not an accidental twig merely, but a little accidental twig. Now, what do you do with little accidental twigs that fall on your lawn? You pile them in a heap and burn them, or throw them in the garbage. And that's, I guess, the view of life that Gould must hold. If we are nothing more than a little accidental twig. Now, the author of the article goes on to say that Gould is simply giving us a little lesson in evolutionary humility. My friends, he's doing more than that. He is destroying the whole significance of mankind. And yet, we've known all along that that's precisely what evolution does. Because, of course, evolution from the beginning has been at war, at all-out war with teleology. Teleology, of course, meaning purpose, that anything has an end for which it was made or created. Now, the Western Christian view of man has always held that man is here for a purpose. The Christian view has been summed up in the catechism question, what is the chief end of man? To glorify God and to enjoy him forever. But the evolutionists would not question whether that is the chief end of man or some other end. but would say there is no end or purpose or teleology in any man's life at all. Now, my friends, when you get rid of purpose, you also get rid of meaning, and you get rid of significance. If something has no purpose, what do you do with it? You throw it out. And no wonder that the second major cause of death among young people today is suicide. Suicide is something which becomes a very live option when life has no meaning at all. And when life has lost its purpose, its meaning, and significance, you are ready for an epidemic of suicide, of drugs, of alcoholism, and even the plunge into maybe Eastern mysticism of some sort, that perhaps there you might find some sort of irrational significance for your life, or at least a feeling of some sort that will make the drabness of your meaningless existence bearable for a time. We have seen in the courts in these past three decades four very significant decisions that have ushered us into this secular apocalypse which we now find ourselves plunged into. There was, first of all, the decision of the Supreme Court that ruled prayer out of our schools, and then they ruled the Bible out of the schools, and then they ruled the Ten Commandments out of the schools, and now they voted negatively against the balanced treatment of creation along with evolution. So we have seen that banished from the thought of our young people is the idea that they have been created by anyone, that there are any laws or moral absolutes which they should obey. And by the way, in that decision where they ruled against having the Ten Commandments posted on the walls of the schools in Kentucky, in that decision they said, lest looking upon them from day to day, the students should be moved to obey them. Ah, alas and alack, we couldn't have that. What would the police and the police dogs do in situations if students were obeying the Ten Commandments? People would be put out of work. Well, what has 130 or so years finally given to us? It is interesting that at the same time, during the last decade, when America has been rushing through court edicts more and more into evolution, at the same time, the basic pillars of the evolutionary faith have been collapsing all around them. And there are many people that suppose that perhaps the evolutionists really have proved their case. And today, we have evolutionists saying that we don't even have to present evidence anymore. Evolution is a fact. It is not only a fact, it is the most thoroughly proven fact in all of science. Nonsense. Let's look at some of the facts that have come to light just in the last decade. Dr. Crick, who, as you know, was the co-discoverer of DNA, which is the master control of all of our genetic development, and which is also that double helix, that spiral that contains all of our genes, is the most complex molecule known to man. And it is so fantastically complex that Dr. Crick decided to apply probability science analysis to the probability of DNA arising by chance, randomness. And of course, the God of evolution is a trinity of matter, chance, and time. And those are the threefold gods of the evolutionist religion. What was the chance of DNA arising by random chance in the entire history of the world the supposititious history, according to evolutionists, which is supposedly 4.6 billion years. Well, he applied the science of probability to that question, and it turned out that it was zilch. That's not a scientific expression, but it describes it very accurately. He got the message very clearly. And this was so devastating to him that what that said, in very simple language, is that not only could a human being never have evolved naturally and spontaneously in this world, in the entire history of the world, but a single living cell could never have evolved, but beyond that, one single molecule within the nucleus of that cell, the DNA molecule, could never even have evolved naturally in the entire history of the world. All of which says that everything that you and your parents and grandparents and children have and are being taught about how life arose spontaneously in some ancient sea is baloney. And Dr. Crick, being honest enough to accept that, however not being an atheist, he wasn't willing to accept creation, so he invented a whole new theory. And as one scientist said, there are two requirements for inventing evolutionary theories. You should know what they are, two requirements. Now you might wonder just where one goes to get this great intellectual capacity to do that, but here they are. One, it depends on your ability to weave a tale. And two, it depends upon the credulity of your audience. Well, with both of those in mind, he came up with a doozy. He calls it directed panspermia. And the idea is very simple, that since life could never have risen here naturally, and since there is no God, which he assumes a priori, therefore some advanced race living on some other planet, revolving around some other sun somewhere out there, or maybe it was there, sent spaceships out into space containing their sperm cells, and voila, here you are. Now, that is simply a lengthening of the shadow. A lengthening of the shadow while you remain in the dark of its penumbra. In logic, it is called an infinite regress. And of course, it is completely without help in solving any problems, as you can see. Because to any thinking person, the question is going to automatically arise, where did that advanced race of people come from? Well, you see, there was this other, more advanced race of people that lived on another planet, and, excuse me, sir, where did they come from? Well, you see, there was a much more advanced, and on it goes, until you finally exhaust the credulity of your audience. However, shortly after that, another scientist of equal or greater fame, Sir Fred Hoyle of Cambridge, decided to examine the possibility of a living cell arising spontaneously, not in the 4.6 billion year history of the Earth, but in the entire history of the universe, which keeps changing from year to year, by the way. And roughly 20 billion years on the outside. And so anywhere, here or on that planet or on this one or any place else, anywhere, even to the entire beginning of the universe, one single living cell somewhere. And he applied the science of probability analysis to that and concluded that the chances of that happening were 1 to the 40,000th power. Do you have any idea what that means? Evolutionists like to have a long time for the age of the earth. Fine. How much were they like? 10,000, not enough. How about 10 billion? 10 trillion. 10 quadrillion. 10 septillion. 10 octillion. 100 million, billion, trillion times 10. Whatever. And do you realize that the figure I just gave is not a tiny fraction of 10 to the 40,000th power? All of which very simply is to say that it never, ever happened. And Sir Fred Hoyle of Cambridge, one of the world's leading astronomers and mathematicians, the father of one of the only two widely accepted cosmogonies of this 20th century, the steady state theory, which lost out in the popularity contest with the Big Bang, but nevertheless, to be inventor of such a thing is quite an accomplishment. And he and another mathematician, Chandra Wickramasinghe, did these computations, and they said that to suppose that somewhere on this earth, by purely natural, spontaneous, random causes, that the entire complexity of the living cell with all of its amazing and unbelievable complexity, that this came into existence by chance is nonsense of the highest order. Sir Fred Hoyle, what your children are being taught as scientific fact and truth, he says, is nonsense of the highest order. My friends, evolution is dead coming out of the starting gate. They rang the bell, lifted the post, and the horse dropped dead. About 10 or 12 years ago, I was sitting in our family room watching an interview being conducted with Sir Julian Huxley. Now, Sir Julian Huxley is the nephew or grandnephew or something like that of Thomas Huxley, who was Darwin's bulldog. Sir Julian, until he died in the last decade, some few years back, was probably the premier evolutionist in the world. And he was, of course, an extraordinarily influential man. And the person who was questioning him said, "Why do you think that evolution caught on so quickly?" And I can still see the seat that I was sitting in, and I can still hear the words that he said. I never in a million years would have thought that he would ever have said anything like this in public. But for some strange reason, and he wasn't in the confessional, this is what he said. "I suppose that the reason that we leapt at the origin, we jumped at the origin of species, was..." Now, I've always thought it'd be interesting to go to a college classroom and begin that sentence, a quote from Sir Julian Huxley, world's leading evolutionist at the time, and ask our college students in a biology or geology classroom to complete it. "I suppose that the reason that we all leapt at the origin was blank." What kind of answers do you think we would get? "Because the evidence uncovered by Darwin was so scientifically compelling that we were forced by pure reason and rationality, by the scientific integrity of our calling as scientists, to accept the facts as true." Something like that, right? I mean, isn't that basically what all of the students in our schools have been taught for the last 100 years? But what was his answer. I almost fell right out of my chair. He said this, I suppose that the reason that we all leapt at the origin was that the idea of God interfered with our sexual mores. Now, mores, of course, are the secular version of morals. Mores are simply what people are doing, and not what God says they ought to do. Because the idea of God, oh, you mean it's not purely a scientific thing. You mean it was an anti-religious, anti-God motive right from the beginning. The idea of God interfered with our sexual mores. Translate that, sexual immorality. Because God doesn't interfere with any kind of sexual mores except sexual immoralities. There it is, my friends. Sir Julian Huxley on the reason for the acceptance of evolution. Well, what has 130 or so years finally given to us? It is interesting that at the same time, during the last decade, when America has been rushing through court edicts more and more into evolution, at the same time, the basic pillars of the evolutionary faith have been collapsing all around them. Dr. Crick, who, as you know, was the co-discoverer of DNA, which is the master control of all of our genetic development, and which is also that double helix, that spiral that contains all of our genes, is the most complex molecule known to man. And it is so fantastically complex that Dr. Crick decided to apply probability science analysis to the probability of DNA arising by chance, randomness, and of course the God of evolution is a trinity of matter, chance, and time. And those are the threefold gods of the evolutionist religion. What was the chance of DNA arising by random chance in the entire history of the world? The supposititious history, according to evolutionists, which is supposedly 4.6 billion years. Well, he applied the science of probability to that question, and it turned out that it was zilch. That's not a scientific expression, but it describes it very accurately. He got the message very clearly, and this was so devastating to him that what that said, in very simple language, is that not only could a human being never have evolved naturally and spontaneously in this world, in the entire history of the world, but a single living cell could never have evolved, but beyond that, one single molecule within the nucleus of that cell, the DNA molecule, could never even have evolved naturally in the entire history of the world. All of which says that everything that you and your parents and grandparents and children have and are being taught about how life arose spontaneously in some ancient sea is baloney. One of the most damaging results of Darwinism, according to Dr. W.R. Thompson of Canada, who is the head of the National Institute for Biological Control, one of their most outstanding scientists, so much so that he was selected to write the introduction to the centennial edition, 1959, of Darwin's Origin of Species. He was a scientist of that kind of stature. And Dr. W.R. Thompson said That one, by the way, he also said that one of the results that accompanied Darwinism was a decline in scientific integrity. And how true that is. We find suddenly the rise of all sorts of fraudulent activities taking place in science. But he said the most damaging thing that it did was that for the first time in the history of science, science had been separated as a result of the followers of Darwin, what finally resulted from it, until we come today, that science is now conceived as totally separated from God, for which was never heard of before in science. Today, it's almost accepted as a commonplace that a creator cannot be conceived and tolerated in the whole scientific discussion. In fact, it is true that during the Arkansas debate, one of the people that testified in that Arkansas trial said that he was reading one of the creation science textbooks and threw it into the trash because it referred to a creator. And now suddenly, if there is any reference to God or to a creator, then somehow this has now become unscientific. And science has been redefined as something which excludes God. Let me give you a few other examples of this same mentality. To quote Stephen Gould again, and I'm really not picking on him, but he says so much. He said in his testimony that creation science was not scientific because it called upon the intervention of a creator to create the world. We see another example of this. Ronald Coward, teacher of biology, said at the same Arkansas trial that a book written by a creationist attributed certain phenomena in the natural world to an intelligent creator, designer, and that therefore it was not scientific. And there are many statements like that today. Well, that raised a very interesting question in my mind. If it mentions a creator, you throw it in the trash. Do you have the ground rules? You understand how this is played? You get a book, and it mentions a creator. Had anything to do with the creation of the world, you throw the book in the trash. We all understand now how the game is played. Let me read you then the last paragraph of Darwin's Origin of Species. Quote, "There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved." A supposed scientific textbook bringing in, of all things, a creator. Into the trash it goes. But, as I say, the descendants of Darwin pushed it farther from the origin of species to the origin of life to the origin of the Earth, the origin of the solar system, and the universe itself, and thus ruled the creator out completely. And so one of the results of Darwinian evolution was to finally get rid of God altogether. Now, I think that that is a most significant fact. And it is having incredibly adverse consequences on the young people in our country today. I remember I debated Dr. Gould one time on a television program, and he said to me, well, after all, it's only a small clique of people, of fundamentalists, that want to have creation taught, and we shouldn't change our academic curriculum because of them. Well, how wrong can you be? According to an Associated Press NBC News poll taken in 1981, 86% of the people in America either want creation alone or creation and evolution taught in our schools, and only 8% want evolution only. Only 8% of the people in this country want what we're getting in our public schools today. Isn't that a tragedy? And he said, you see, this small group of fundamentalists who are the only people that want this, which of course is not true at all, really are using it simply to import their religious views. They have this exterior motive that they want to bring, an ulterior motive rather, that they want to bring religion into the schools by teaching creation. Now, of course, Dr. Gould would not have any ulterior motives, would he? Or would he? Well, he has stated a couple of things in print. Namely, that one, that he did have other motives, and one was to advance his liberal political views. And just how liberal are they? Well, he and Eldridge stated, another article, learned their Marxism at their father's knee. So who is it that is importing other views, who has other ulterior motives for bringing evolution into the classes? Now, you've been told that this must be done because, you see, evolution is science and creation is religion, right? We've been told that over and over and over again. And that was the basis of Judge Overton's decision in the Arkansas case, and that ran all through the majority decision of the Supreme Court case on the Louisiana Balanced Treatment Act. But I would like to quote to you one of the most insightful discussions of this matter that I have ever read, and it comes from Justice of the Supreme Court Scalia, and it was concurred in by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Justice Rehnquist. And this is what he said, and this is what is happening to our children today. This censorship of creation science has at least two harmful effects. First, it deprives students of knowledge of one of the two scientific explanations for the origin of life and leads them to believe that evolution is proven fact. Thus, their education suffers and they are wrongly taught that science has proven their religious beliefs false. The United States Supreme Court, he continues, has held that secular humanism is a religion. How many times have you said that and had people deny it? Well, here it is again. And he refers to Torcaso versus Watkins, 1961, where they said, among non-theistic religions in North America are Buddhism and, among other things, ethnoculture, secular humanism. The Supreme Court has said that it is a religion. He goes on, belief in evolution is a central tenet of that religion of secular humanism. Thus, by censoring creation science and instructing students in that evolution is fact, the public school teachers are now advancing religion in violation of the Establishment Clause. How about that? That is Justice Scalia of the Supreme Court of the United States in a decision rendered in the past year, and Chief Justice Rehnquist. Now the facts are, my friends, that evolution is easily as religious and actually more religious than creation. Why do I say that evolution is religious? There are more religions that are based upon evolution than there are upon creation. Creation is held by conservative evangelicals and fundamentalists who are Christians, by things like the Church of Christ and Seventh-day Adventists, and the Catholic scene, Orthodox Roman Catholics. I'm quoting Wendell Byrd now, who wrote the brief for the Supreme Court, and Eastern Orthodoxy, Jewish Orthodox Judaism, and Islam and some Hindus. But religious evolutionists, evolution is taught by theological liberalism and neo-orthodoxy. Now, do you know what that means? That means most of the mainline churches in America, Protestant churches in America today. That means most all of the mainline theological seminaries in this country are being taught some form of theistic evolution. So you have a vast array of denominations that are involved in doing that. And by the way, these same denominations have filed friend of the court briefs opposing having creation taught in our schools. And I'm talking about mainline branches of the Episcopal Church and the Presbyterian Church and the Methodist Church and many of the other denominations who are teaching some form of theistic evolution. Also, neo-modernist Roman Catholicism, vast areas of Roman Catholicism teach some form of theistic evolution. In Judaism, Reform Judaism and humanistic Judaism, non-Christian religions, Buddhism and most of Hinduism, secular humanism and other humanist-based faiths, and many non-theistic religions as well as atheism, which is also declared to be a religion and by the Supreme Court. So there has been, and there is today, a tremendous number of religions that are based upon, believe in, and teach some form of evolution, more than those that teach creation. Now keep in mind that you can teach creation as biblical creationism, in which you are going to deal with such matters as God creating the world in 6 days, and what it was created. You're going to deal with Adam and Eve and with the fall and with the flood and things like that. But you can also deal with scientific creationism, which is what we've been asking to be taught in our school. And that is does not teach the book of Genesis at all. It deals only with matters of scientific concern. What does scientific creationism deal with? It deals with biology and anthropology and paleontology and anatomy and physics and geology and stratigraphy and chemistry and stereochemistry and biophysics and biochemistry, astronomy, astrology, cosmology, cosmogony, ichthyology, botany, thermodynamics, probability analysis, etc., etc. And that's all I could write down in just a few minutes. Just off the top of my head. Now, those terms are not even found in the Bible. It's dealing with scientific material, and the scientific evidence of creation is overwhelming. So much so that leading evolutionists on both sides of the ocean, as we have seen tonight, have just admitted that the basic pillars that have held up evolution for over 100 years have collapsed in the last decade. And just at that time, the courts are saying it must be taught, and the evolutionists are saying, why, it is a proven fact. It is the best proved fact of history. It needs no evidence. Which reminds me of the note in the margin of the preacher's sermon, which says, argument weak here, pound pulpit. Evolution is a fact. But you know, it is encouraging that the truth is getting out. And the number of people becoming interested in and becoming convinced of the scientific evidence for creation is growing at a phenomenal rate. Just since 4 years ago, there has been a tremendous number of more people who have become aware of the truth, that they have been fed fairy tales and that they have been deceived. Even as Dr. Colin Patterson, the chief paleontologist of the British Museum, said that he woke up one day and suddenly realized that he had been deceived and deluded into thinking that evolution was a proven fact. And he asked himself one morning, what do I indeed know about evolution for sure? Now, this is the chief paleontologist of the British Museum, which has the largest collection of fossils in the world. He said, nothing. And he asked a whole group of evolutionist meeting shortly thereafter at the Field Museum in Chicago, can any of you tell me anything that you know for sure about evolution? Silence. Finally, one man raised his hand. Now, this is a world gathering of evolutionists, and they don't know anything for sure about evolution. Which, of course, is the best proven fact of history, of the history of science. One thing I'm sure of, Dr. Patterson, we ought not to teach it in high school. We're teaching it in kindergarten. But the truth will out, and I am sure that the day will come when evolution will be recognized to be the pernicious and harmful theory and falsehood and deceit and fairy tale that it really is. And people will realize at length that it is a great and glorious creator, the almighty, omniscient God who has created the world and you and me. May it so be, and may it come soon. Thank you.